Chapter 3. If not for his dog Rio chasing some imaginary furball around the back of the old Paulson place, Nikos Irwin would most likely never have found the big cellar at all. It was a kind of unlikely accident, or maybe not, not if you knew Rio and the qualities of stubbornness and curiosity she had inherited from her Bernese mountain dog ancestors. But if not for Nikos and his stubborn pet, the whole subsequent history of mankind might have been different, for better or worse. It was April of 2052. Nikos was 10 years old. It wasn't as if Nikos particularly liked the old Paulson house, or the abandoned township it was part of. It was just that the Paulson place was used as the local swap house, and he'd been sent here by his mother in search of baby shoes, for her friend, Angie Clayton, was carrying. So, with Rio loping at his side, he walked out of the shade of the trees, out of the dense green where somewhere a band of forest trolls hooted a gentle song, and into the harsh, unfiltered sunlight. He looked around at the big houses that loomed silently over this open space. Nikos had grown up in the forest, and instinctively he didn't like clearings, for they left you without cover, and this abandoned community was an odd place besides. His parents always told him that the long earth was too new to mankind to have much history yet. But if there was history anywhere in Nikos's own world, it was here. Some of these old houses were being swallowed by the green, but the rest still stood out in the light, hard and square and alien, with their peeling whitewash and cracked windows. The place even smelled odd to Nikos, not just of general decay after years of abandonment, but of cut wood and dried-out, dusty, lifeless ground. All this was basically the work of the very first colonists to come here, the founders. They had opened up the forest to build their little town. You could still see the neatly cut and burned-out stumps where great old trees had been removed, and the fields they'd planted, and the tracks they'd marked out with white-painted stones, and of course the houses they'd hammered together in a few short years, with their picket fences and screen doors and bead curtains. Some of the houses had stained-glass windows. There was even a little chapel, half-finished, with a truncated steeple open to the elements. And in one big old house there was even, incredibly, a piano, a wooden box which somebody must have built from the local wood and fitted out with pedals and an inner frame and strung with wire, all carried from the low earths, a remarkable feat of almost pointless craftsmanship. Nikos's parents said the founders had been keen and eager and energetic, and when they'd come travelling out to these remote worlds more than a million steps from the datum, the first world of mankind, they'd had a kind of fever dream of their past, when their own ancestors had spread out into the original America and had built towns like this, towns with farms and gardens and schools and churches. They had even named their town New Springfield. But the trouble was, this wasn't colonial America, and this earth wasn't the datum. Nikos's father said that this world, and a whole bunch of similar earths in a band around it, was choked with trees from pole to equator to the other pole, and he meant that literally. Here there were forests flourishing even in the Arctic night. Certainly this footprint of Maine was thick with trees that looked like sequoias and laurels, but probably weren't, and an undergrowth of things like tea plants and fruit bushes and ferns and horsetails. The warm, moist, dark air fizzed with insects, and the trees and the loamy ground swarmed with furballs, as everybody called them, jumpy little mammals that spent their lives scurrying after said insects. And in such a world, the founders' children had soon started to explore other ways of living, in defiance of their parents, the pioneers. Why go to all the hard work of farming when you were surrounded by whole empty worlds full of ever-generous fruit trees, and rivers full of fish, and forests full of furballs so numerous they were easily trapped? Oh, maybe farming made sense on the more open worlds of the Corn Belt. But here? The drifters who came through here periodically, calling themselves Comers or Okies or Hobos, vivid examples of other ways of living, had helped inspire the breakaway. Nikos's parents' friends still spoke of one particularly persuasive and evidently intelligent young woman who had stayed here for a few weeks, preaching the virtues of a looser lifestyle. Pioneers tended to have their children young. The sooner you raised a new crop of willing workers, the better. But the numerous children of New Springfield, growing up in a world utterly unlike their parents, had quickly learned independence of mind and had rebelled. Most of the youngsters, and a good number of their parents, had given up and walked off into the green. The will to maintain the township had kind of dissolved away. Indeed, it had only lasted one generation. Nowadays, the Irwins and the other family groups didn't really have permanent residences at all. Instead, they had a kind of cycle of living places, which you'd visit according to the fruits of the gentle seasons, and keep clear of fresh brush with a little burning, and repair last year's lean-tos and hearths. So they'd climb Manning Hill on one particular world a couple of steps east in the spring months, when the squirrel moles came bursting out of the ground to choose new queens and found new burrows and were easy to trap. Or, in the fall, they'd go to Soulsby Creek, four steps further west, where the annual spawning run of the local salmon was particularly rich. Nikos had grown up with all this, and knew no different. As for the old township itself, meanwhile, as they grew old and weary, a lot of the founders had gone back to the datum. A few disappointed pioneers had clung on as best they could, and their relatives had kept an eye on these aging heroes. Nikos's mother told a wistful story of how she used to hear one old lady play that piano of an evening, and Chopin waltzes would waft out into the silence of the world forest, music written down in a century long gone, and in a world very far from here, and sometimes picked up by responsive choruses of forest trolls. But the piano lost its tuning, and there came a day when the music ceased altogether, and now nobody played the piano anymore. Even after it had been wholly abandoned, though, Nikos's group worked together to keep the New Springfield clearing open. It had some uses. Everybody needed a snapper box, and for that, you needed potatoes. And potatoes needed cultivating, so that was something useful to do with the remains of the founders' farms. It had taken somebody a lot of effort to build the forge beside the Paulson place, and that was kept functional. You couldn't carry iron across worlds, and preserving the craft of ironworking seemed another good idea. Some of the animals the founders had brought here, chickens and goats and pigs and even sheep, had survived and bred. Every so often, you'd be surprised by a wild descendant of those first porcine colonists bursting out of the undergrowth before you. And this one house in particular, the old Porson place, sturdier than the rest, had with time assumed a new role. It had become the swap house, as everybody called it, a place where you could dump and exchange stuff of all kinds. Which was why Nikos was here today. He walked cautiously across the clearing, towards the Porson place. With one hand on the sturdy bronze knife he carried on his left hip, the other on the stepper box on his right, he was very aware of his surroundings. He had no real fear of the local wildlife. As far as wild critters went, there were only three hazards in the forest: the ant swarms, the big birds, and the crocs. Well, he was too far from water for the crocs, and the big birds were ferocious but were used to chasing little forest furballs and were heavy and clumsy and slow-moving as a result. And if there was an ant swarm around, he'd hear it coming long before it came sloshing over the ground like some gruesome corroding liquid, destroying everything in its path. Also, the forest trolls would almost certainly sing out any danger, in time for Nikos to step out of its way. Almost certainly. Nikos had seen for himself one unwary kid get caught by a big bird, and it had been a terrible sight. And so you kept an eye out, because of that weasel word, almost. No, the reason Nikos was so cautious was because, among the kids at least, there were stories about this particular house. Legends, if you liked. Legends about things that lived in there. Oh, not just scavenging furballs and such, and not just the familiar monsters of the forest. Something worse yet. An elf, maybe, trapped in there, a long earth nasty, broken and bent and old, but still vicious, and just waiting to feed on unwary children. Or maybe, went one variation of this, it was the ghost of one of those very children, waiting to take revenge on those who had forced him or her to go in here in the first place. Of course, it made no sense. Nikos was old enough to see the flaws in the logic. If the Porson House was haunted, why would the adults be using it as a store? Yet he was still enough of a little kid to be scared. Well, stories or not, he wasn't going back without what he'd been sent to get, that was for sure. Or the mockery of his buddies would be worse than anything any monster could do to him. As he reached the porch, Rio sniffed the air, yelped, and went running out of sight around the corner of the house, maybe on the trail of some unwary furball. Nikos paid the dog no attention. He opened a creaking, unlocked door, pushed his way inside and looked around. Only a little daylight was able to struggle through the green film that was slowly covering the windows. He had a wind-up flashlight that he dug out of his pocket now, so as to see better in the murk. The hairs on the back of his neck prickled with unease. He was used to teepees and lean-tos, never mind ghost legends. It was quite alien for him just to walk into a box of wood all closed up. Still, he walked deeper inside, treading cautiously. One main room dominated much of the house. He knew that was how these houses had been built. You started with one big space where the whole growing family lived and ate and slept, and added on others when you could, such as a kitchen, bedrooms, storerooms. But this house, like most of the others, hadn't got that far. He could recognize stuff from the times he'd been here before, under the supervision of his father. The big old table standing in the corner, the hearth under a half-finished chimney stack, the floor covered with a scattering of rugs woven from reeds from the creek and coloured with dyes from local vegetables. But the room was cluttered with junk, dusty old debris, heaped on the floor and the table and piled against the walls. Yet it wasn't junk, not quite. The people of the forest were always short of stuff, because everything they had was either brought from the Datum Earth, or the Low Earths, or they had to make it themselves, and either way, cost a lot of effort. So if something broke, a bow or a bronze machete, or a digging stick, and you couldn't be troubled to fix it, you dumped it here in the swap house, the theory being that somebody else might make use of it, or at least bits of it, the bronze for melting down. A busted bow as a trainer for a little kid. There was a useful store of bits of wire and relays and coil formers, the kind of stuff you needed to make or repair a stepper box or a ham radio. There was even a heap of fancy electronic goods from the Datum, phones and tablets, all black and inert since their batteries or solar cells had finally failed, their inner parts too fine and fiddly to be reusable. Even these were sometimes taken away to be worn as jewellery, or as shiny gifts for the forest trolls. And there were always clothes, especially children's clothes, underwear and pants, and shirts and sweaters and socks and shoes, much of it brought from the Low Earths, some made here. The adult stuff was generally too worn out to be useful, but Nikos picked out a few colourful scraps for the latest quilted blanket his mother was making. Even rough shreds could be used to pack bedding and the like. The kid stuff, though, was often barely used before the child in question grew out of it. The people of New Springfield were a mobile nomadic people and carried little with them. They certainly weren't going to carry around baby shoes for 20 years, on the off chance of some grandchild coming along some day to wear them for a couple of months. And it was baby shoes that Nikos was particularly looking for today, for the benefit of Angie Clayton's unborn. After some rummaging, he found a pair of beautiful little moccasins, sewn from the scraped hide of some unfortunate furball. Shoes that sat on the palm of his hand like toys. That was when he heard Rio yelp, and a sound like wood cracking, and a rush like a heavy mass falling into a hole.